I'm Tommy McNeil. Washington is straining to respond to the worsening coronavirus outbreak. Tempers are flaring in Congress as lawmakers argue over a nearly $2 trillion economic rescue package. Senators wrangle over critically needed aid. Democrats blocked another vote to advance the package, arguing it is tilted toward corporations. U.S. President Donald Trump signed an executive order Monday to prevent hoarding and price gouging of crucial medical supplies needed to fight the deadly coronavirus, while U.S. Attorney General William Barr announced that the Justice Department has already launched hoarding investigations to carry out that order. The executive order authorizes the U.S. government to directly target hoarders who may threaten the supply of certain medical supplies that the government has designated as scarce or could be threatened by hoarding or price gouging. People who accumulate designated supplies beyond levels considered reasonable for personal or business use can be criminally prosecuted. The first of two U.S. military hospital ships was dispatched on Monday to boost hospital bed capacity as the number of U.S. coronavirus cases swells. The U.S. naval ship Mercy departed San Diego with nearly 900 staff on board to take on non-coronavirus patients and allow local personnel to manage those on shore with the virus. President Donald Trump on Sunday said the Mercy would be dispatched to Los Angeles, while the USNS Comfort would go to New York. The Mercy is expected to arrive at the port of Los Angeles later in the week. And China's National Health Commission said Tuesday that by the end of Monday, there were a total of 78 new cases of the coronavirus, with 74 cases imported from overseas. Also Monday, 7 deaths in Hubei province and 35 new suspected cases were reported. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is blasting Afghanistan's rival leaders. Pompeo made a previously unannounced visit to Kabul Monday, sought to end the political crisis and salvage the peace process with the Afghan Taliban. But after the visit, Pompeo said that they were unable to agree on an inclusive government, and he announced a $1 billion cut in U.S. assistance to Afghanistan for this year. Cuba's government said on Monday that it is banning Cubans from leaving the country, closing schools, and suspending interregional public transport in a fight to prevent the spread of the new coronavirus. Havana started to seriously ramp up measures last Friday when it barred foreign tourists from entering the Caribbean island nation that relies heavily on tourism for hard currency. Cuba has so far confirmed more than 36 cases of the virus. Cubans and foreign residents returning to the island will be able to return home, but will have to isolate in camping facilities, college dormitories, and other institutions designated by the state for 14 days. Meanwhile, none of the more than 32,000 tourists still in Cuba would be allowed to leave their hotel from Tuesday onward, and all excursions are banned. The company Honeywell said it ramped up production of N95 masks in its facility in Smithfield, Rhode Island, to support the U.S. government's response to the novel coronavirus. The same facility also produces UVX safety glasses used by health professionals treating coronavirus patients. In another effort to help fight COVID-19, alcoholic beverage maker Bacardi Corporation shifted production last Tuesday to make the main component of hand sanitizer, ethanol, at one of its largest rum distilleries in Puerto Rico, a U.S. territory. IOC members, National Olympic committees, and athletes were all racing toward the same conclusion on Monday. The Tokyo Olympics are not going to take place this summer. Craig Reedy, a longtime member of the International Olympic Committee, told the Associated Press that everyone can see where things are headed with the coronavirus pandemic spreading and Olympic hopefuls around the world unable to train. In the balance of the probabilities, information known about the condition in Japan and COVID-19's effect on the rest of the world, the likelihood of postponement is happening, Reedy said. Health experts say that Nigeria is not likely to meet the United Nations tuberculosis eradication target of 2030, as the nation still accounts for the highest fatality rate from the disease in Africa. Officials say they continue to try to address major factors like inadequate awareness and funding by offering free screening via remote.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Africa orders a 21-day lockdown to slow the spread of the coronavirus.
The National Coronavirus Command Council has decided to enforce a nationwide lockdown for 21 days with effect from midnight on Thursday, the 26th of March.
Zambia civil society calls on the government to close its borders. An expert says it is time for Africa to dispel the myth that the coronavirus does not affect Africans. Today is World Tuberculosis Day. And Malawi's Elections Commission announces new elections timetable, but a civil society group says the commission cannot be trusted to supervise another election.
Our stand still remains the same on the Malawi Electoral Commission led by Jane Ansah. We don't have trust in her and the entire commission because they messed up the last general elections and we can't give them another chance.
Luke Tembo is the national coordinator of the Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition. And the Guinean government says Sunday's constitutional referendum and parliamentary elections went well despite violence. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa on Monday announced a 21-day shutdown to try to curb the rapid spread of the coronavirus in South Africa. As viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg, the announcement came the day after the number of cases rose drastically.
It's official. As of midnight Thursday, the Rainbow Nation is on lockdown. All businesses other than clinics, pharmacies, and food stores will close for 21 days. All residents must stay home except for essential staff. President Cyril Ramaphosa announcing the measure on live television Monday night.
The National Coronavirus Command Council has decided to enforce a nationwide lockdown for 21 days with effect from midnight on Thursday, the 26th of March. This is a decisive measure to save lives of South Africans from infection and save the lives of hundreds of thousands of our people. While this measure will have a considerable impact on people's livelihoods, on the life of our society and on our economy, the human cost of delaying this action would be far, far greater. The nationwide lockdown will be enacted in terms of the Disaster Management Act and will entail the following. From midnight on Thursday, 26th March, until midnight Thursday, the 16th of April, all South Africans will have to stay at home.
He made the announcement on the day that the number of coronavirus cases in South Africa jumped to 402. The highest caseload in sub-Saharan Africa, and an overnight increase of 128 cases. That caseload, however, will look paltry if the virus goes unchecked. He estimated that hundreds of thousands of South Africans could be infected, which is more than the nation's overburdened health system can easily support. Also, he noted the nation has the world's highest burden of HIV, meaning millions of South Africans are already prone to opportunistic illness. The move echoes other African nations' steps to try to stop the spread of the virus. Rwanda was the first African nation to announce a lockdown, issuing the order for a two-week lockdown on Saturday. And on Monday, the Democratic Republic of Congo's second-largest city began a 48-hour lockdown. Ramaphosa also announced a number of measures to try to keep small businesses and informal workers afloat in the continent's most advanced economy. And finally, speaking grimly off the teleprompter, he assured the nation that they will overcome this challenge.
In the days, weeks, and months ahead, our resolve, our resourcefulness, and our unity as a nation is going to be put to a test as never before. I call on all of us, one and all, to play our part and our role as South Africa, to be courageous, to be patient, and above all, to show solidarity and compassion to one another. Let us never despair despite the challenges that our country is facing now. For we are a nation of one, and we are surely going to prevail. May God protect our people. Nkosi sikelela iAfrika, Morena, Boloka sechaba sa heso.
His final words are lyrics from the multilingual national anthem. In the Xhosa and Sesotho languages, it means, God bless Africa. Lord, we ask you to protect our nation. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Zambian Institute of Governance and Civil Liberties Advocacy Platform is calling on the government to close the country's borders with 8 neighboring countries. The group says this will bolster the government's efforts to combat the spread of the coronavirus. Frank Chipili tells viewers Peter Clotte that his group wants the government to implement more restrictions in order to prevent the spread of the disease.
As the Zambian Institute of Governance and Civil Liberties Advocacy Platform, what we are demanding now is for the closure of all the borders, because all the cases of the coronavirus have been imported in. So when you look at our financial capacity, our health institutions, we don't have the leisure to wait until the pandemic spreads for us to institute drastic measures so as to arrest the coronavirus. The Zambian government has an opportunity now to be bold and make those tough decisions. And those tough decisions include closing the borders immediately. We are appealing to the government of Zambia to immediately close the borders. Any further delay will be very catastrophic on our nation. As you may know, our towns, our townships, our compounds are very populated, densely populated. And for as long as any case is recorded in those townships, it will be very difficult for the government to arrest. Now we have an opportunity to learn from other countries that delayed in implementing drastic and proactive measures to try and combat and keep the virus away from the borders. We have the virus within our borders, and so it's important that we don't allow any coronavirus externalization into Zambia.
Francis, as I understand it, officials of the administration are monitoring the situation across the country to determine the next line of action after closing down schools and setting gatherings to ensure the spread is not rampant or to curb the spread. Don't you think this is a strategic move by the government?
Yes, Peter, that is a strategic move, but it's not enough. Like I alluded earlier, our population, the demographic, the spread of our population, when you look at, for instance, when you take a look at Lusaka, we have a problem of street vending. Street vendors are congested, are congregated in the central business district. And so there's clouds there. When you go to the market, open markets, those markets are crowded. So, and that's potential. Those are high-risk areas. When you look at our borders, not just at the international airports, even the land borders, you find that those borders, the monitoring is there, but the measures, in my view, and in the view of the Zambian Institute of Governance and Civil Liberties Advocacy Platform, is that the government needs to intensify such actions. Because I recently traveled from Lusaka to Luapula province, and I transited through the Congo, and I observed it through myself on my own and discovered that the measures, the gaps are too wide. So there's high risk that the virus can come in from.
Frank Chipili is the chief executive officer of the Zambian Institute of Governance and Civil Liberties Advocacy Platform. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotte. As of late last week, the number of coronavirus cases in Africa were more than 600 in about 34 countries. Now, that number and the number of countries are growing by the day. Dr. Elvis Njai, president of the International Organization of African Nurses, says the rising number of coronavirus cases in Africa means it is time to dispel the myth that the virus does not affect Africans.
We understand that as of this moment, according to the Africa Centers for Disease Control, Director Dr. John Kingasong, there is more than 600 confirmed cases of COVID-19 all over Africa, actually from 34 different countries. And so there is a myth out there that this virus doesn't affect Black people, that COVID-19 doesn't affect Africans. That is not true. And we should be educating our people. We should be helping to stop the spread of this infection by telling our people this is real. It could get worse before it gets better. And so we have to take precautions now to avoid the worst from happening.
Based on what you are hearing, Doctor, do you think most African countries are prepared for this virus, for how to deal with this virus?
The simple answer is no. Even though Ebola tested some of our healthcare systems in sub-Saharan Africa, we are not ready for COVID-19. Some countries like South Africa and Senegal are increasing their testing, but that is not enough. Most other African countries, we have seen under testing. The test kits are not available, and so we are not ready. The best we could do at this point is prevention. People have to start listening to what the healthcare departments are saying. So avoid, you know, crowded places. Avoid going to, I would suggest to put a hold on going to church for now. You can pray in your home and God is still going to hear you. We have to be part of the solution here.
So Dr. Njai, let me ask you a layman's question. What is the correct answer for anyone who, let's say, has the COVID-19 virus? Is it likely the person will die or can the person be cured?
The answer is no. Most people who actually have this virus do not die from it. There has been over 200,000 reported cases so far worldwide, and there's been less than 10,000 deaths from the coronavirus. The problem in the context of Africa is that this virus is going to be fatal for people who are older, right? So for our elderly, our grandmothers, our grandparents. And so if you are young and healthy, you contract the virus, you know, your body's immune system can fight against this virus and you'll be fine. But imagine you having the virus and not developing symptoms. And then you come home to your grandmother, you hug your grandmother, you talk, you guys eat from the same bowl. And then she ends up with the virus and then she dies. So the simple answer is understand your risk, prevent yourself from catching the virus. If you feel sick, stay home. If you are able to avoid going out, please do that. Listen to the healthcare professionals on this one.
Dr. Elvis Njai is the president of the International Organization of African Nurses. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 24. Tuberculosis is still the leading killer disease in Kenya and Africa as a whole. As the world marks World Tuberculosis Day today, Tuesday, the World Health Organization says over 25% of deaths occur in Africa annually. As Marie Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, Dr. Philip Owiti, technical advisor of the Kenya National Tuberculosis Program, says at least 150,000 Kenyans are infected with tuberculosis annually.
Today, March 24th, is the world's tuberculosis day, and according to World Health Organization, tuberculosis is still among the leading killer disease in the world and in Africa. According to Kenya's health ministry, by the year 2023, the government will have a new strategy to diagnose and cure at least 597,000 people with tuberculosis. A TB survivor, Sheila Baraza, says that it took hospitals longer than usual to diagnose her with the multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis, hence taking longer for her to cure.
I was treated for typhoid, amoeba, and it took me around 3 months before I knew that I actually had TB. The treatment from the beginning did not make any changes, and it took me around 5 months without getting well. And when my condition became worse, I decided to seek help from my neighbor who works in Kenyatta. That's when I was taken to Kenyatta. I was told that I have actually had MDR-TB. I began my treatment on MDR-TB. And from there, the journey was quite hard. The medication was hard, harsh for me.
The emergency of multi-drug resistance TB possesses a major health security threat and could risk gains made in fight against TB. Another patient, Vivian Faith, says her journey with tuberculosis started in the year 2017 to 2019 when she fully recovered. She says misdiagnosis was also the reason she took long to cure. Vivian stigmatized herself because she didn't want people close to her to know that she was suffering from tuberculosis.
I was afraid also to let some of my friends know that I had TB by then, because I already had self-stigma and I couldn't even imagine my friends stigmatizing me. But some would even come to where I stayed. And since I have a little knowledge about tuberculosis, I would open up the door and make sure there's enough circulation of air inside the house when they come in. I'd like just to say that let us all work together to help in monitoring the TB treatment and its effects.
At least half of Kenyans who have tuberculosis have not started treatment. This is according to Dr. Philip Owite, a technical advisor, National Tuberculosis Program Kenya, who says the government has put into place measures to ensure all tuberculosis affected patients are on treatment.
Out of this total number of people who have TB annually, we are able to detect and actually put on treatment slightly above half of this. So that means that more than half or close to half actually and are still not yet diagnosed and put on treatment. So the country at large, of course, with the National TB Program leading the efforts, have put mechanisms to ensure that all these people who have TB are detected.
Kenya is still losing patients with tuberculosis who are on treatment. Dr. Owite says children below 5 years and patients who are HIV positive are at high risk of getting tuberculosis because of low immunity. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
The Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition, HRDC, says as far as it is concerned, Malawians no longer have confidence in the Malawi Elections Commission and its chairperson, Justice Jane Ansa, to preside over another election. HRDC National Coordinator Luke Tembo says Justice Ansa and her commission will not have another chance because they messed up the May 2019 presidential election. Yesterday, Wednesday, ANSA and her commission announced that the court order fresh election will take place on July 2nd this year. HRDC National Coordinator Tembo says the group will continue to demand Justice ANSA's resignation because she no longer has the credibility.
Our stand still remains the same on the Malawi Electoral Commission led by Jane Ansa. We don't have trust in her and the entire commission because they messed up the last general elections, and we can't give them another chance to preside over the coming presidential elections as ordered by the Constitutional Court.
President Mutharika and the Malawi Elections Commission have appealed the ruling of the Constitutional Court. Until then, don't you think she has the power to do what she just did?
What we understand is that the Malawi Electoral Commission and the ruling Democratic Progressive Party are here to delay and buy time. A few weeks ago, the Public Appointment Committee, as ordered by the court, called upon all the commissioners for a hearing. They put up a recommendation as per what the laws prescribe, a recommendation to the president indicating that the current crop of commissioners, including Jane Ansa, were incompetent of presiding over another election. The Public Appointments Committee of Parliament recommended that these should be relieved of their role and responsibilities at the Malawi Electoral Commission. Now the president has refused to fire them and has also refused to assent to the electoral reforms bill. While the commission may be within what the law prescribes up until the appeals court make its determination, it is clear on the ground that people don't have trust. And that's where the danger is. If she refuses to go, probably people will not have confidence in the results of the elections that she is going to preside over.
In the wake of COVID-19, the coronavirus, do you think it's possible to have the election, say, May 19? Or do you think the Elections Commission took into consideration the virus when it put the election to June?
In a way, I would think that the Electoral Commission took into consideration the COVID-19 pandemic in pushing the elections to June as opposed to May as determined by Parliament. But I think what is of paramount importance is that the elections should be conducted within the 150 days as determined by the Constitutional Court. Anything out of the 150 days becomes a contempt of court.
Luke Tembo is the national coordinator of the Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. The Guinean government says Sunday's constitutional referendum and parliamentary elections went well throughout the country, except in the capital, Conakry, where the government says opposition militants destroyed ballots and polling places. Information Minister Amara Sampare says security forces arrested two opposition supporters with guns. He defended President Alpha Conde's decision to hold the referendum despite international concern. Sampare says Guinea is a sovereign nation and decides what is good for its citizens.
In the whole country, the referendum and the parliamentary election votes went pretty good. We had, unfortunately, some incidents in a certain zone in the country and in the capital city. We had, unfortunately, some destruction of some vote station. But globally speaking, the election went good.
We did speak with a member of the opposition who accused your security forces of at least using live bullets and killing two of their supporters. But the opposition admit that its militants carry on destruction of the voting materials. Could you tell us who was responsible specifically for the violence?
The minister in charge of security is given now a press conference. It has started 10 minutes ago to clarify all these issues about violences. But what I can say so far is that the violence came firstly from opposition, because they send people to destroy vote station. They send people to block the population that wanted to go to vote, and they even use gun. We arrested two of them attacking vote station with gun, which is illegal and completely dangerous. Because of that, numerous police officers have been injured, and some Conakry citizens that were doing their vote also get injured. So it is still sad to have violences.
President Conde has not yet said whether he wants another term in office, but the opposition says that he's doing this because he wants to stay in power for another term. Now, why does the president find it necessary to have this referendum, even though ECOWAS, even the Francophonic countries, and some, say, the United States and European Union, has advised against having the referendum?
Again, Guinea is an independent country, and the people of Guinea is sovereign. They can decide on what is good for them, what they want to do, and they can do it themselves. What is true is that the Francophonie organization, the ECOWAS, and some observers made some comments on the electoral file. And the CENI, the institution that organizes election in Guinea, take into account all those recommendations. They corrected the file and organized the election without more than 2,400,000 Guineans. So personally, I don't understand why after applying the recommendation, they say that they're not going to be participating in the oversee, the supervising of the election. But we had other observers come from Africa and elsewhere, and the election went very well yesterday.
Amara Sampare is Guinea's information minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. And that's it for this Tuesday, March 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping you will have a great day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of the UAE's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.